Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 244 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me is Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Well, hi, and before I tell everybody good evening, I wanted to see how many people have noticed the way Max has changed the intro to the show.
What do you
he
mean?
Used to say, well, you used to say, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. And now you say, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. I mean, it's quite a radical shift for us. So
no,
I just wanted other.
Up.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Listen, I mean, my mind works completely different now because of the way you start the show. So I just wanted other people to know that. So, okay.
All right. Did you say hello yet?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Hello from beautiful Chicago, where we had 67 degree temperatures and now it's raining and on its way down to 40. But hey, it's spring.
Delightful. Well, our other co-host, David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian, is off tonight. So it's me, Rob, and our guest, who this episode is Jeff Nielsen, also known as Captain Jeff. Now, Jeff served in the Air Force as a C-141B and T-37 instructor pilot. And then he flew for a large legacy airline, like still does, flown the Boeing 727, the L-1011, and also the MD-88 and 90. So, Jeff, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks for inviting me on your show.
Now, Jeff, you also produce the Airplane Pilot Guy podcast, which I love the subtitle. The subtitle is The View from My Side of the Cockpit Door. And I guess you could kind of describe that as sort of news and views from an airline pilot's perspective. How long have you been doing the podcast?
Well, let's see. I started in September of 2009. So let's see. I don't do public math. So I guess we're getting close to about 3.5 years, I guess.
Fantastic. And one of the things I like about it is you have a lot of interaction with your listeners. Lots of questions come in from your listeners about airlines and flying.
I do. Yeah, the show has kind of evolved over the years, and it's kind of turned into mostly a Q&A thing because I find that a lot of folks out there have a lot of questions about aviation in general and then airline flying in particular, especially, you know, the life of an airline pilot.
Yeah, great. Well, we've got some questions, too, even a few that Rob can't answer. So I think you'll be good to help us out with those.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, I noticed that. No slight intended, huh, Max? So that's all right. Yeah, that's fine. Fine.
Okay. He's really slamming you.
No problem.
I just want to know, Jeff, is your mustache as big as it is in that graphic?
Is my head really that big? Is that what you said?
No, no, your mustache. No, I know you're an airline pilot. We know how big your head is. Come on.
Yeah, I kind of people, I'm known for my mustache. People give me a bad time about it. Yeah, that, too, has evolved over time.
I'm sure. All right. Well, coming up, we'll talk with Jeff about being an airline pilot, maybe even some more about his mustache. But first, we've got some aviation news we're going to talk about. And then later, we've got Steve and Grant. Actually, we don't have Grant. Grant is off as well. And so we have just Steve with the Plane Crazy Down Under Australia Desk report. And actually, he's enlisted Ben to help him out for this installment. And then in this week's Across the Pond segment, Peter Johnson brings in Gareth Stringer, his fellow co-host on the Extended podcast, who's also editor at Global Aviation Resource. And we have another listener story. This time it's Andrew Brown and his flight in a tiger moth. And we'll finish up with a bit of the listener mail that we've received lately. We've been getting an awful lot. It's hard to keep up with it all, but we'll do our best. First, though, we've got the aviation news from the past week. Is everyone ready?
Of course!
First story comes from CBC Canada. This is Porter aims to become Canada's third national airline. Well, Porter started operations in October of 2006, and they offer, I think, what they like to consider a premium service to a variety of destinations from Toronto's downtown airport. They fly 70-seat Bombardier Q400 regional turboprops. but they have just ordered quite a large number of Bombardier C-100 jets, which is kind of a new area for them, quite a bit different from the turboprops. And they're looking to expand beyond the markets that they support now. First off, I mean, this is great news for Bombardier, right? We've been hoping for some more C-Series orders.
You know, I think what's interesting about this is it's going to completely change Porter Airlines, because Porter Airlines goes into Toronto, downtown Billy Bishop Airport, and they don't allow jets in there. So it's going to be real interesting to see how this is going to change, because that means Porter's going to have to start going to other locations. I'm sure they're going to keep their Q400s, but or try to get the folks in Toronto to change their mind about what they allow into the airport. But it's going to be a whole change of life for them, I think, not to mention debt.
Oh, for sure. You know, that agreement, the limitations they have, I took a look at that, and that agreement goes back to 1983, and it runs until 2033. This is an agreement, I guess, with the Toronto Port Authority and the City of Toronto and Ottawa. And as you mentioned, Rob, it prohibits jets from operating at Billy Bishop Toronto City Airport. So they have that hurdle. They also would need, according to the press, to extend the runway. In fact, add 1,100 feet to the runway, because that's also limited by this agreement. I mean, that's kind of a big challenge.
I think these
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jeff.
No, I was going to say, I think these are huge hurdles, especially, you know, you think that some certain groups in the United States are environmentally conscious. Canada's even, you can multiply that by several factors. I don't see how they think that they're going to get this kind of thing approved, you know, a runway extension and operating jets at an airport that close to the city.
It's kind of surprising that they... you know, they announced this deal with Bombardier in advance of getting those agreements. I mean, I think some of the politicians up there are a little bit angry because Porter announced this deal without getting them on board.
Well, I kind of wondered if there wasn't some subtle pressure there on those folks. Maybe they thought that if they went ahead and did it, maybe Toronto cares enough about the traffic that they're bringing that they'll be willing to negotiate. Who knows what else they were thinking, such as the fact that they're going to pull out of Bishop completely, which I can't believe they would. That is such a special place for them. That's like the soul of their airline.
Well, maybe they keep the Q400s there and develop a new hub for the jets.
Well, maybe, but then they're coming up against Air Canada and WestJet, which... I'm sure are large enough now to fight back. So I don't know. That's an odd, you know, because Porter's had a little struggle the last year or so. Anyway, even with their Q400 traffic, so this is quite a bold move.
Bombardier is planning the first C-Series aircraft, the first flight, by the end of June in this year. So we're just a couple of months away from a first flight. And Bombardier is saying entry into service a year later, so 2014. So, I mean, we've been talking about the C-Series for a couple of years now, and we're getting closer to actually seeing one in the air, which will be great.
Well, I just hope that they're not using lithium-ion battery technology.
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure what they're using. That's a good question. Have you, Rob, have you seen anything in the press about that? I haven't.
I would have thought that if Bombardier was using that kind of a power source, we'd have seen something about it, because a lot of other manufacturers have, really stood up and said, yeah, that's us, or, you know, we're not. Well, look at the Airbus people. They've said, we're not going to do that.
Yeah,
and of course, some of the business jets have pulled out of that market. I believe that the 650 Gulfstream was going to be lithium ion at one point early on, but that was changed long before this Boeing issue ever came to be. But for a number of reasons. But again, what I've read about the technology in general is that it's just a little prickly. And I was listening to your show. Jeff, where you were talking about the the ETOP certification on the 787 when it comes back. And I think you mentioned that might go down to, what, 2 hours or something if it came back, but that you didn't think they were going to get the 330-minute exemption. I might have that fact wrong, but.
No, that's what I was reading anyway. There were some.
I mean, but think about that. If you had a battery melting down, 2 hours, it's not going to make a whole lot of difference if you're within 2 hours. I mean, because if a battery goes, it goes, and I guess I would feel a lot better about the entire battery issue with Boeing if they said, oh my gosh, we just realized what the problem was. It was a particular percentage of a chemical that we were using in the spacers between the cells, and now that we've changed that, something. But they don't have any idea. And all they're doing is protecting the thing from, you know, becoming a flammable box. Yeah. We've talked about that before, and I don't know, to me that's a little scary.
Yeah, me as well. I'm thinking that instead of finding, as you said, the source of the problem, we're going to make something that's going to contain something that we know is going to have a thermal runaway and be on fire.
It's just such a bizarre strategy. I mean, I can't recall anything remotely approaching that kind of a strategy ever, but I mean, I guess it's working. At least I haven't seen anybody stand up and say, you know, no, we're not going to do that.
Well, but, you know, Jeff, you mentioned something on your show the other day that I thought was really important, is that if they conducted that flight, I think it was a week ago Friday now, and nobody has said a word about it, good, bad, or otherwise. And FAA certainly didn't jump in and say, okay, guys, you got it. I mean, nobody's saying much of anything. I even asked our ace Cub reporter, John Ostrower from the Wall Street, about it, and he said, we haven't heard anything either. So, I mean, and if Snoopy John can't find anything out, I mean, nobody knows.
What'd you call him?
Snoopy John. That's our new name. We're going to start, instead of John Ostrower on I think he's at John Ostrower on Twitter, we're going to do at Snoopy at WSJ or something like that. I think it's only fair.
Well, I tell you, it has been suspiciously quiet, and I've been reading that the FAA is really taking its time on determining whether or not to recertify. Well, I guess recertify is not the correct terminology, but to allow the airplane to fly again. And some say that this is going to be Ray LaHood's last major decision, and he wants to make sure he gets it right this time.
Wait a minute. Okay, wait a minute. Ray LaHood is an Illinois politician, and I defy you to tell me about any decision he's made in the past. And I'm not even talking about good decisions, any decisions.
Okay, well, maybe the people that are working for him and their decision making.
Right, okay, all right. No, but I think you're right, and FAA is really, really worried about this one. Because imagine if let's face it, if the airplane gets certified and flies fine for a year or two and everybody has forgot about this, and then something happens, you know, God forbid an accident, but even another battery meltdown someplace, that airplane will never fly again.
Well, it'll certainly be a tough time. Yeah, they'll go over the whole thing with a fine-tooth comb, and that'll take a while.
Yeah, it'll be a mess.
All right, well, hey, let's push out. We've kind of drifted off, but that's okay. our second story, it's actually our second, not our third story, comes from the Washington Times. It's too bad David isn't here because this is titled Drones Replace, quote, the Right Stuff. Fighter pilots make way for remote warfare. So this describes that at Nevada's Nellis Air Force Base in 2011, senior Air Force officials, they ordered this sign, which said home of the fighter pilot, to be taken down. So why did they want to take it down? Well, apparently they wanted to be more welcoming for the drone operators, which, of course, many of whom are based at Nellis. It's kind of a sign of the times, but the article is also interesting because they're talking about how the Air Force is flying fewer hours and the readiness rates are dropping significantly. I'm not sure what's the cause and what's the effect here. I mean, I'm not sure if it's the coming of the drones or what, but there's definitely shifts. The wind has shifted at the Air Force.
Well, I think it's a combination of things. You know, the lack of money obviously is a factor there, but I think also the predominance of the drone technology, which I think is well placed in that application. You know, putting airplanes over in high risk combat situations is a good use for drone technology. Now, when you're talking about using drones over here in, you know, airspace that passenger flights and general aviation flights are using, now I have a problem with it. But I think that it's a combination of the two.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, Jeff. I was going to ask you about that because we know Rob is not a fan of the thought of even commercial aircraft being flown by, either remotely or autonomously. Jeff, do you think that's an opinion that's held pretty widely amongst the pilot community? It must be, right?
Oh, absolutely. And most people would say, well, of course. You know, you guys like the buggy whip analogy. You know, where the buggy whip companies, you know, went out of business because the cars, you know, put the buggies out of business. But so I don't really think that that's the reason why most of us say that drone or autonomous or somehow you know, remotely piloted vehicles carrying passengers will never happen, because many of us, and Rob, you can probably you know, share this opinion as well, have flown in highly automated airplanes and seen what happens sometimes with the automation. It doesn't always work. There's a reason that there are pilots on board, and that's, you know, that's just one factor. Also, you know, when you are somebody that has a dog in the fight, because you're in the airplane itself. I mean, if I can just see myself, you know, hey, if one of these companies offer me a job to sit in my living room and flying a passenger flight from New York to San Francisco and pay me some good money to do that, and I'm sitting there in my Barco Lounger looking at the radar and go, that thunderstorm doesn't look too bad. I'm not in that airplane. I'm not going to have to, you know, I don't have any you know, investment in this personally. And you know what I mean? I'm exaggerating, of course.
Yeah, but that's the first time I've heard that, you know, that argument. And, you know, that makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, you know, right. It's funny. It's the first time I've thought of that the same way. And I think that's a very, very valid point. I mean, the number of times that radar shows one thing and you look out the window and you think, we're not going that way. I don't care what that says. We're not going that way. We're going this way. And that's what you're there for. That's what you get paid the big bucks for. And I'm sure someday, 100 years from now, when people are listening to this in the ruined archives of Airplane Geek Central somewhere, they'll say, can you believe those guys never thought people would actually get into an airplane that was remotely flown? And but I certainly wouldn't myself, because I know what I mean. It's funny. I work here in this studio where I'm at. I mean, we're using a PC to do all the audio work, and in the office side, the Macs run all the really heavy duty stuff. And the number of times that I have to reboot this stupid PC, and this is a fairly new one. There's always something that just gets a little off kilter. And I grant you, I realize the systems are more sophisticated in the airplanes, but to completely get rid of the bodies, I don't think so.
Mm-mm. No, I mean, you made some good points there, but I've experienced this several times where I fly, you know, very sophisticated airplanes that have double to triple redundant systems to fly coupled autoland approaches. And more than a couple of times, I've been handed the airplane because something just didn't quite check out exactly right in the logic. And it basically said, oh, okay, you have the airplane. And I can't imagine what's going to happen when one of these airplanes without a pilot, I don't think it's going to ever happen, or at least in my lifetime. But you know, that's going to be a major disaster because nothing there to take over.
Yeah, I mean, I can see how in military applications, as you mentioned, Jeff, where you've got a high threat level, and it's a different kind of environment altogether. And while certainly there are combat situations where a man or a woman in the cockpit is going to offer the best outcome, there's others where it's just safer to remove the human being from the airplane and let someone remotely operate the thing.
What a segue into the next story, right?
Well, this is really interesting, I thought. We picked this up from the Independent. It's titled, Researcher Shows How to Hack and Crash a Passenger Aircraft with an Android Phone. And this is pretty interesting. Well, there's this guy, Hugo Tesso. He's a security consultant at something called N.Runs in Germany. And he presented some work at a conference in Amsterdam. It's called the Hack in the Box Security Conference. His talk was titled Aircraft Hacking, Practical Aero Series. Now, this is amazing. And, this made me think of claims by the Iranians that they commandeered that drone that they landed so easily. What this guy has done is looked at some of the systems, the ADS-B, for example, the Automated Dependent Surveillance Broadcast. All right, that's a technology that is used for, I guess, tracking aircraft, but it has no security. The system is unencrypted and unauthenticated, and it's vulnerable to attacks. And he also looked at ACARS, the Aircraft Communications Addressing and Reporting System. And I guess, what would you guys say? That's used for exchanging messages between the aircraft and ground stations? Is that kind of what ACARS is for?
Well, that's at my company, Acme Airlines. That is what we use it for mostly, communicating between the flight and the dispatcher, communicating to the maintenance control center, getting the automatic terminal information service information, putting in data as far as, like we need three wheelchairs and, we have two unaccompanied minors, that kind of information, communications, basically.
And what this security consultant says is that system also has no security. So he's kind of proposed that those could be hacked in order to do some things with the flight management system. And he's kind of tried to demonstrate this in a lab environment. And some people have been critical of this, but his lab is with X-Plane, the flight simulator, which is pretty realistic in many ways. And what he tried to do was sort of tinker with the system to see if he could produce some results in the lab. And I guess he's saying that, with these open systems, these unencrypted communication systems, there's a vulnerability there, and someone could do something to a commercial aircraft. That's kind of scary.
Well, it is interesting that when you think about all the times that we've been involved in situations where security has been overcome, and someone says, "Wow, we just never thought anybody would do that," and fill in the blank. And we actually didn't pair these two stories up about the pilotless airplanes and this particular technology hacking on purpose. They just kind of came up that way. But how could you not be thinking that way? That's really the thing that frightens me more about the drone issue than anything else. Not necessarily that they're going to lose the data link to the unit. And I know they're supposed to circle, or they're supposed to go home, or whatever it is they're supposed to be programmed to do. But that's assuming that the reason that you've lost communication is not, that someone else has grabbed control away from you. And wait till it happens. Who knows? Nobody ever thought they'd be using airplanes as weapons either.
That's right.
Well, I have a lot to say about this. In fact, I'm going to talk a lot about it in my next episode.
Okay, good, good.
Let's see. I guess I can't use that word. Hogwash. it's one thing to hack into a vehicle that is designed to be either autonomous or remotely piloted, and it's completely another thing to hack into an airplane, an airliner, such as I fly, because it just doesn't work the way that this guy thinks these things work. First of all, he buys the Honeywell unit, FMS unit, off of eBay. And then, as you mentioned, he uses a PC-based simulation software program, which is not exactly the same as what we have in our airplanes. But even if you could do all that, let's just say in the airplane that I've flown and every airplane that I've flown so far, the ACARS system and the FMS system, they're not really attached to each other. They don't communicate at all with each other. Well, I guess on a lower level they do, but not any kind of a flight plan change kind of thing or an altitude change kind of thing. But let's just say that would work and somehow somebody could, with their cell phone, give a command to the ACARS system, which in turn gives the command to the FMS system. The pilots, the humans that are sitting up there in the cockpit, are going to go, "What's the airplane doing?" And then immediately, any pilot worth his or her salt is going to immediately hit this little button. It's called autopilot disconnect. And then now you've basically taking control of the airplane, and you're not letting it happen. The other thing that I read, that somehow he can push a button and the thing could descend and he could crash the thing. Well, even if you put an altitude command in the FMS system to change flight levels, unless you change the altitude, I can't think of the name of the thing now all of a sudden. There's a display that we put the altitude in, and if it's not changed, the FMS cannot drive the airplane off of that altitude. It just won't happen. So there, I think, is a very basic misunderstanding exactly how these FMS systems work. And then the thing that really made me laugh was, how you make all the lights flash and the warning systems go off and the oxygen masks drop. I looked today. I spent a lot of time going from Atlanta to Minneapolis, St. Paul, and then Minneapolis, St. Paul down here to Tampa. I'm on layover right now here. And so hours in the air today working through the FMS system trying to find that command to make the oxygen masks drop. There is no such thing. I don't know where they come up with this stuff.
Well, I mean, that's great. I'm glad to hear you say that because that makes me less worried than I was before.
But that's current technology airplanes, okay? And I guess to me at least, I agree with you, Jeff. I doubt seriously anybody is going to aim their radar dish at a passing MD-80 or a 757 or something and suddenly take command of the airplane. But of course, the electronics that I've seen in some of the new business jets, I mean, and what they will allow an airplane to do in a fly-by-wire situation. I mean, you are completely dependent upon the electronics. And, I'm not an engineer. I mean, maybe we've got some great engineering listeners out there that can say, you are full of whatever it is I'm supposed to be full of. But I'm just saying that years down the line, as the technology evolves and this constant demand for let these airplanes fly, be flown from the ground, it just scares me that somebody's going to put 6 and 9 and 11 together and come up with something that nobody ever thought of. So, but I agree. It's not going to be happening tomorrow.
Now, look, there is reason to be concerned. If somebody can relatively easily hack into these unprotected, unencrypted systems, I'm hoping that these companies will say, ooh, I guess we need to do something about that and make them more secure and more protected. And as I said, I know that we do have some airplanes on the fleet that I fly for that you can send a flight plan change to the FMS, but I don't think you can do it in flight. I'm not sure about this, but I know you can do it on the ground. But again, the pilot has to accept the change and hit the execute button before anything happens. And I guess you're right. I guess it's theoretically possible that somehow you could somehow get into the code and avoid the necessity of, hitting an execute button. And you also make a good point. I don't know anything about the Airbus systems, and I know that they're very – automated and electronically controlled. So perhaps there is reason to be concerned. But as far as any of the airplanes that I've ever flown, and I've asked a bunch of people since this thing came out that fly more sophisticated aircraft for my airline, and they've all said, no, it wouldn't happen. It couldn't happen. But again, I think that the drone situation, that's something entirely different. That's something we really do need to be, you know, concerned about.
Well, I guess my conclusion on this is that I believe that there are some extremely clever people out there, and some of them just are motivated by a challenge, and that's it. And others are motivated by, you know, some evil intent. But there are some very clever people out there, and while maybe this isn't something that could happen today or tomorrow, but as long as there's communications, as long as there's data flowing that's not encrypted, it represents a vulnerability. So yeah, I'd like to hope that, you know, this is kind of a wake up call, perhaps, for the manufacturers to take a look at this and try to make the systems that exist today more secure, but also going into the future with the new aircraft, new products that are coming down the line, that's a design consideration. I think it needs to be.
I'm just going to take the bus or the train now, from now on.
Walk, it's safest. All right. Hey, one more story very quickly. This is from Time. This is investigators probe jets crash into sea in Bali. Well, we've had Lion Air in the news recently for ordering large numbers of airplanes, but they're in the news again because one of their new, and I mean like brand new, 737-800s. I think this thing is less or about a month old. Well, it missed the runway while attempting to land on the island of Bali. So it went to the sea with 108 people on board. The water was shallow. The airplane kind of broke in half, but no casualties. So I guess they're pretty lucky in that regard. But boy, there's some dramatic footage of this thing just sitting off the end of the runway in the water. How do you do that? How do you miss the runway?
Well, that's a good question. I think a lot of us are scratching our heads. And I think, of course, one of the first things that I jumped to a conclusion, and I'm sure many did, was that they were landing the other direction on runway 27 and just slid off the end. Because most runways around the world are not grooved or you know, they don't have that porous friction overlay, so they're kind of slippery when they get wet. But in fact, he was coming in from the other direction and just didn't quite make it to the runway, it appears. And it's painful to look at that brand new 737-800 basically totaled.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that thing is there is no future for that airplane.
No, maybe in an amusement park or something, but not for flying.
Right.
I don't know. What do you guys think about, you know, perhaps you've talked about Lion Air in the past, as you mentioned, as far as, you know, massive orders and that kind of thing. But I didn't realize that they are one of the handful of airlines out there that have a system, at least they used to, I don't know if they still do, pay to fly, that the first officers aren't paid, that they actually have to pay to fly as first officers on those jets.
Really?
For that airline. Yeah.
I didn't realize that. Had you heard of that, Rob?
No, I had never heard that either.
Well, so I didn't know that. Now, I don't know if it has anything to do with this particular situation. The reports that I've read say that the first officer was the pilot flying and that the captain took over. Recent reports are saying that perhaps the weather conditions played a part, perhaps a wall of rain and perhaps a microburst kind of a situation here. But then I've also seen that although they said they were below the glide slope, there really isn't an electronic glide slope for that particular approach to that runway. From what I could find out, it's just a VOR approach, a non-precision approach. So I don't know. There are a lot of factors involved here, and I don't think we're going to be able to really determine exactly what happened until we get some more information from the investigating authorities.
Sure. And from the aerial view of the airport there, I mean, both ends of the runway pretty much end right water. I mean, there's no land on either side of the runway. It's the runway. You're on the runway or you're in the water. That's it.
So we don't know for sure that these guys landed short, but it sounds like they probably did. Is that your take on it, Jeff?
Well, what I've been reading recently is that they definitely were coming in for runway 9 and they undershot the runway. They never made it to the runway.
Yeah.
They somehow, short of the runway, about 1 nautical mile short of the touchdown zone, they just plunged down. So some, you know, so that could be one of those situations like the Turkish Airlines crash in Amsterdam, where they had a little trouble with the autothrottle system and didn't recognize it quickly enough, installed and crashed. Or it could be a situation like the Delta flight, that the L-1011 that crashed with the microburst in Dallas back in the 80s. So I don't know.
Yeah. And that's, I think that's the key. We don't know right now, but we will.
But it's fun to speculate, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and especially since on this one, at least nobody got hurt. And how? When was the last time you saw an airplane broken into, you know, 3 or 4 big pieces, and nobody was seriously injured? I mean, that doesn't.
Yeah, I think they were lucky.
I think this guy was trying to be another Sully Sullenberger. You know, so
yeah, that's a tough act to follow. I mean, I think there's more than a little bit of skill and more than a little bit of luck involved in pulling one of those off. Again, our guest this episode is Jeff Nielsen, Captain Jeff from AirlinePilotGuy.com. Jeff, again, thanks for joining us on the show.
Again, my pleasure.
You know, one thing I want to ask you about, you know, recently we've seen that someone was convicted of pointing a laser at an airplane, and this guy got caught and he got jail time. And I think that's the first case of this where the guy was caught and he got jail time. And I said, hooray. But just how dangerous is this to when folks flash lasers up into the cockpit of an airplane?
Well, it's never happened to me, thankfully. And the only thing that I can say that has happened to me that is similar to this is a very early morning flight, still dark, coming in from Mobile to Atlanta one early morning, and we were flying through a little bit of weather, but it was December, so we weren't thinking thunderstorms or anything like that. There was nothing on the radar to indicate any convective activity, but we did notice a little bit of electrical activity on the nose cone of the airplane, something we call St. Elmo's fire. And then all of a sudden...
Oh, yeah, sure. So that's, describe what that looks like.
Well, it's really odd. It's kind of a circular aura or a... wow, it's hard to... Like a glow that starts coming off the nose of your... I guess it forms on anything that is pointed in some way. And because, you know, you're sitting looking out the windscreen at the pointed end of your airplane, naturally that's going to be a place where this kind of electrical static electricity is going to build up. And we were kind of just mesmerized by it a little bit. And then all of a sudden it decided to disconnect or whatever it does and makes a huge flash, like a big bolt of lightning hitting and making a large, very, very stunningly loud noise, like a cannon shot. And a very, very bright light, like a huge lightning flash. And we were going through about 10,000 feet. Luckily, the autopilot was still connected at that time, and basically it just completely destroyed our night vision. And I remember my first officer saying to me, can you see anything? And I said, no. Can you? He said, no. And it seemed like it was a long time, but probably just seconds, before we started regaining our night vision again and could actually see. But it's very dangerous. And again, you know, luckily... we weren't hand flying the airplane at the time because that could have been kind of dicey. But laser beams or whatever are very dangerous because when your vision is affected, it's just not good. And it could actually do permanent physical damage to your retina if it's a strong enough beam.
Yeah, and actually having come back from a conference in Montreal last week where they were talking about lasers, I was listening to a flight surgeon talk about the reason that you know, we only see these things happen at night is because most of the time during the day, is it the pupil? I guess that's what changes the size and lets in the amount of light, I guess, right? But your pupils are so tiny in the daytime that even if a flash did go off, it won't have nearly the effect it would at night when your pupils are almost dilated. I mean, and on top of what Jeff mentioned about that startle factor, depending upon the power of the laser, you can do some seriously permanent damage to a person's eyes with that.
Wow. Well, I'm just really happy they caught this guy, and I'm especially happy that he's going to have, I think he got 10 months in jail, I think, for this little stunt.
Something like that. You know, he was not the first. I think it was actually the second time that they've actually convicted somebody and given somebody jail time. But the thing that is just amazing to me is the stupidity of this guy. He first shines it at a business jet. And then after the fact, they send out a police helicopter to try to find the guy. And then he shines it at the police helicopter.
So this guy's not too bright. Huh.
No, most criminals aren't. But, I guess man. He's not really a criminal. But, very crazy.
Wow.
Well, and the only reason he's not a criminal right now is that nobody's crashed.
Right.
I mean, they were talking about helicopters specifically in Montreal about the fact that the bubble canopy on a helicopter can make this laser flash issue, I forgot how many times worse than it is in an airplane, because it's round and light just bounces in a million different directions when it hits. And so, and most of these guys are out there flying at night alone. And, it ain't pretty, but we just haven't had any accidents yet. But wait till the first one happens.
That's a good point, Rob, because, most cases that I've seen where pilots have been affected by lasers, it's one of the pilots, and there's, usually at least two of you up there. But in a situation when you're flying an airplane, solo, one pilot, that's very dangerous.
Well, of course, I just thought of it as we mentioned that. I mean, if you were a single pilot in a helicopter and somebody flashed a laser at you and you crashed, how would anybody know what it was? What would the evidence be on the ground? If you had FOQA data, digital flight data information somewhere, I mean, how would it ever give anybody a clue about that? Boy, that's an interesting one.
Yeah, it is.
Well, let's talk about Jeff's show.
All right, yeah, airplane pilot guy. So
okay, that's enough. we don't want him to get a big head.
Just it's airlinepilotguy.com.
Yeah, so there's the basic. So are you also, what else, where else are you on? Do you have, are you on Twitter? Yes, I know you're on Twitter, aren't you?
Yeah, I don't do Twitter that much. I kind of my social media is mostly on Facebook, but I just find that that's a better fit for me. But I am on Twitter, Airline Pilot Guy, all one word. And then I have a Facebook page, facebook.com/airlinepilotguy. And my personal Facebook page is Captain Jeff, CaptJeff.
And what was the sequence of these activities? Did you start the podcast in the beginning, or were you blogging first? What's the history?
No, I'm not a writer or blogger at all, and I became at the beginning of this new media thing called podcasting back in not me personally, but I was involved in a way helping support a nonprofit, a Catholic global podcasting network. Back in 2005, 2006, and I became involved with the network and, a board member and doing all kinds of, behind the scenes work and support. And back in 2009, as a joke, I said that I was going to start a podcast. Many of our podcasts, because it's a Catholic network, have names such as Catholic Family, Catholic in a Small Town, that kind of thing. And I said, I'm going to start a podcast and I'm going to call it Catholic Pilot. And I said it as a joke. And everybody on the board of directors said, hey, that's a good idea.
And they took you up on it.
Yeah, really? So I thought, okay, well, I had this idea that I would talk, a little bit about my faith and flying, because I know something about both of those. And I quickly realized that almost everything that people were interested in, 99% of it, was questions about aviation and airline flying and that kind of thing. And I thought, maybe I need to, you know, just make this a plain old aviation podcast instead of trying to do both. So I kind of rebranded it a couple of years ago to the Airline Pilot Guy. And so that's, you know, again, it kind of started as a show where I thought I'd kind of pick a topic and kind of talk about that, maybe take some questions at the end of the show. And it turned out that mostly I answer people's questions. So that's, I'd say, 80, 90% of the show now. And I love doing it because it's easy to come up with content.
Yeah, there's just lots of people with lots of questions, sure. So how do you balance that with flying? I mean, because you can be a lot of different geographic locations. Do you just wait till you're back at home base to record, or do you record on the road?
Actually, what I try to do is I try to do it while I'm on layovers, because I'm trying not to take away that precious time that we have when we're not flying to do all the things we have to do at home, you know, things around the house and being with the family and that kind of thing. So I tried to make it a very high priority for me not to do the show while I was home. Now, there have been a couple episodes where I've just been either just so tired on a trip or didn't have time to do it or whatever that I just waited to do it when I got home and did it from my home studio, my basement studio, which is pretty much the same as my mobile studio. And so most of the time I just do it in my hotel room. In fact, I usually start the show by saying that I'm in studio 415 at the Doubletree Hotel and so. So
yeah, right.
I kind of just have fun with it. And sometimes you'll hear, the maids coming in the room and the telephone ringing, my co-pilot saying, "Hey, let's go out and have some dinner," or whatever, So it's just a fun part of the show, some ambiance, I guess.
Do you know Betty in the Sky with a Suitcase? Do you know that podcast?
I do know that podcast, but I don't think, it's possible. I think she flies for Acme as well.
I was going to ask if you've ever met Betty.
Well, I don't, it could be that I've actually flown with her, but I don't know for sure. I mean, I've never, recognized her or, knew that it was Betty in the Sky with a Suitcase. So I fly with a lot of Bettys in the Sky with suitcases, and but they're not named Becky or Betty. But I don't know. So I'm not sure about that.
Well, Betty tells stories or has stories told by people that she runs into along the way, other flight attendants, other crew, and so forth. Some of the stories are just classics, just absolutely fantastic stories. But I was thinking, you must have run across some pretty amusing situations over the years yourself. Have you got a sort of a favorite story that you could relate?
Oh, I have. Well, I mean, just so many different types of stories, some which I can't really even talk about on the show. I don't know. Favorite stories? I like to talk, and it seems like my listeners like to hear me talk about flying with different captains when I was a first officer. And for those of you out there who are co-pilots or have been, you understand what I'm talking about when you have to be a chameleon. When you fly with different captain personalities. And one of my favorite captains that I used to fly with, and I really did love flying with him, it's just that he was a kind of a guy that with a short stature and a very short temper. But actually he was harmless. But you didn't know that when you'd hear him explode when something didn't quite go the way he thought it should. And which is something I never really understood, because when you're the captain, basically the buck stops with you. And sure. There's no reason to get upset, because even if somebody is pleading with you, let's say a mechanic or whatever, to fly the airplane in a certain condition or whatever, all you have to say is, I understand where you're coming from, but I'm not going to do that. Just be nice and calm and collected. But this guy would always just screw himself into the ceiling. And the swearing was worse than any sailor could ever do. And it was really, he turned red. I mean, really, beat red in the face. He'd be yelling. He'd be swearing. And then a few minutes later, he would start slowly coming down, being unscrewed from the ceiling. But everybody would be very startled by the reaction. And so I would used to tell when I was a co-pilot on the 727, I'd tell the engineers, I said, "Hey, have you ever flown with Captain, let's call him Captain Bob?" And he'd say, "No." I said, "Well, let me tell you what's going to happen. because I know it's going to happen. And so sure enough, when that would happen, I said, don't worry about it. It's going to really scare you, and you're going to be startled by it, but it only lasts for a few minutes, and then he'll come back down to Earth, and he's really a fun guy to be with. So that was one of my fun captain stories, I guess, that I like to relate. But several others. I mean, I used to have fun with these false teeth, these very ugly buck teeth. And in fact, to this day, I mean, I haven't used these fake teeth for probably 15 years at least, but I still have people yelling at me across the concourse saying, "Hey, Bucky!" And they're really bad buck teeth, and I used to slip them in when I could sense that one of the flight attendants was coming up into the cockpit, and I'd be like doing something in my flight kit, and I'd pop them into my mouth, and I'd turn around, making sure that she had a clear view of my mouth, or he had a clear view of my mouth, and they'd be in there asking, "Well, you know, would you like something to drink?" And I'd always say, "Yeah, I'd like a Dr. Pepper or a Coke or whatever," and then they'd walk out, and 9 times out of 10. They would have to come back into the cockpit and say, "I'm sorry, what was it that you wanted to drink?" Because they were so taken back by this look of these terrible teeth. I mean, they're hideous. And
they are. This is the picture that's on your site, right? A couple of...
I think that somebody asked me about pranks and April Fool's jokes and that kind of thing. And so it was a couple episodes ago. I have a picture.
Yeah, it's hard to look at. I mean, you look at this picture, it's like, oh my God, because it's they're incredibly real looking, but incredibly ugly at the same time.
And what was great about them is that you could actually, if you fit them right, you could actually eat with them, you could drink with them. And so I know a lot of times that they'd be up there. This is, you know, before 9/11. And so the flight attendants would be up in the cockpit and they'd hang out for a while up there with us just to take a break. And I could tell many, many times that they were like giving me things to eat and drink just to see, you know, these could not be real. So they would see if, you know, I'd have to take them out to eat something or drink something, and I'd be just sitting there, you know, talking to them and eating and drinking, and we'd have a lot of fun with them. In fact, a lot of times my other crew members would escalate the thing by, you know, going on layover in the van and just start really giving me a bad time and making fun of me, and then it was really funny to see the flight attendants come to my defense, and then finally I'd, you know, pull the things out of my mouth, and they'd say, inevitably the first reaction for them was, "Oh my gosh, you know, he makes enough money where he could get these things fixed." And the other reaction was, "Oh, look, he's got a wedding ring. He's married. Oh my gosh, bless her heart." So that was a lot of fun. But again, I haven't done that in many, many years. So
yeah, that seems like the kind of thing you need to pull out every now and then just to keep your sanity.
Yeah. And I sometimes along with that, you know, the Coke bottle lens kind of glasses that are thick. I'm sure you've seen those at costume jewelry stores and that kind of thing. You know, you put those on in combination with the teeth and say goodbye to the passengers as they were leaving. You know, it's kind of funny to see their reaction when they see you like that.
So what's the mood these days amongst airline pilots? I mean, I know that's kind of a broad question. It's going to depend on what company you're working for and so forth. But, you know, is the thrill still there? Is there still passion? Is it just a job for most people? What's being an airline pilot like these days?
Well, Max, that's a good question because it really depends on why you got into this job to begin with. And, you know, there's probably going to be the same percentage in any industry where people really have a love and a passion to do something, in this case, flying, and others who decided that, hey, I'm going to do this airline pilot thing because they get a lot of time off. Well, it used to be that way. And they make, you know, really good money. That used to be that way. But you know, they get into it for the wrong reasons. They get into it for the lifestyle and the money and not really the flying. And, there fortunately is a significant number of us, out there who, you know, since we were 8, 9, 10 years old, we wanted to fly airplanes. I mean, that's what I wanted to do. When my family would go to Los Angeles International to take family and pick up friends and that kind of thing from the airport, I just loved, you know, just watching the airplanes and smelling that burnt jet fuel and watching the airline crews walking down the concourses. And I thought, that's what I want to do when I grow up. And I've always wanted to do that. And I just love flying. I still do. And so, you know, like many of us like to say, you know, don't tell anybody, but I would do this for nothing. Well, not nothing, but you know what I mean. I would make sacrifices to do this because I actually really love doing this job. And you make a good point as well. And it really depends on the company you're with. I mean, there are probably people listening right here that have been with airlines that they're not doing so well, and their contracts are horrible, and they're working, you know, really long hours and not making that much money, and they're struggling, and it's really hard to keep that passion for flying when, you know, you're having to worry about how you're going to pay the mortgage and care for your family. So, I've been very lucky. You know, Acme has been for the most part, a very solid airline over the years, and I've never been furloughed, thank goodness. I'm knocking on wood, and right now I'm in the, you know, the top 20-25% of the pilot seniority force, and so if it ever got to the point where I was furloughed, it pretty much means that this company is going out of business. So I have some, you know, I feel like I have some security, so that really helps. But the general mood, I'd say, right now at my particular airline is, for the most part, pretty good because we got a pretty decent contract, you know, last year. We'll be in contract negotiations probably pretty soon. But I think, again, the future looks pretty decent for us as far as contracts are concerned and pay and everything else. So everything feels like it's on the upswing for us at Acme Air anyway. So,
Jeff, I'm curious, do you think as things sit right now, you can imagine yourself still flying when you're 65 or flying up until you're 65?
Well, you know what? I honestly, you know, before they changed that rule, I was kind of looking forward to retiring at age 60 and enjoying my pension. But as many people know, most of the airlines now have gotten rid of those pension plans. So I'm responsible for making sure that I save enough money for my retirement. And now that they've pushed the age to age 65, and now, of course, the reality that I still have my youngest child is 16 years old. So she still has 2 more years of high school and another 4 years at least of college. I'm going to be, you know, paying tuition till at least I'm 61 years old, 62 years old. So now it's kind of almost like a necessity. I'm going to have to work as long as I'm physically, you know, medically qualified to do it until I'm 65. And honestly, I don't dread that because I still love it. I'm hoping that I'll still love it, you know, when I'm in my 60s. Right now I'm 54 and a half, so I have a little bit more than 10 years remaining in my potential career. So I'm hoping that I keep my nose clean and I keep my health up, that I can continue to fly until I'm 65.
All right. Well, let's see. I think we should move on. We've got some other segments we want to do. So, Jeff, I want to thank you again for joining us. It's been a great conversation. Really encourage people to take a look at your podcast, AirlinePilotGuy.com. Lots of interesting stuff and a voice that's not too hard on the ears.
Well, thank you very much. I really enjoyed being on the show. Thanks for inviting me. It was a real treat. And I like to say to my listeners that there are so many great podcasts out there. Of course, yours being at the top of the list, but there are several others out there that are a little bit different and kind of have a different perspective and a little bit different feel to them. And I think that it's important to listen, you know, sample at least all of them and see what you like. And I know that many of my listeners, it's funny because I listen to your show and then I hear people, you know, sending in feedback on your show. And I'm thinking, hey, that's my listener. How dare them send feedback to you? No, I'm just kidding. I think it's great because it's good, you know, cross pollination, I guess. And again, it's just me on my show. There's no panel. And it's all my perspective and my opinion about things. And I certainly don't hold to the idea that my opinion as an airline pilot is the same as every other airline pilot. And that's not true at all. You know, we all have different perspectives and different ideas about things. But so I just try to make the point that, hey, it's just me, one airline pilot flying the line. And this is what I think about what's happening in our industry and what I'm concerned about. And I'm there to answer your questions.
And you're doing a great job at it, too. Very good. Thanks, Jeff.
Yeah, but, you know, if you ever really get lonely doing it alone, you could always you know, put together a sock puppet and make it sort of an alter ego. And then, you know, yeah. You know, well, hey, listen, you know, when you work by yourself, you have to be creative. I mean,
now, do you guys have some kind of private video that you've taken with me? How did you know about the sock puppet? Just kidding.
Oops.
Cat's out of the bag.
Hope the psychologists aren't listening.
That's why. Oh, are you kidding? My wife's a shrink, so she goes through all the shows and the really wacky people she sends cards to. So. It's the new business. We're going to try and start an internet shrink service. And
so I should expect a card from your wife. That's what you're saying.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In fact, she's so conservative, though. I found a great idea. I said, we could call it shrink wrap. And she said, you're kidding, right? And I said, no. And she said, oh, my God, listen, please just don't do what I do. But I guess maybe I don't have what it takes for that. But listen, Jeff, it was really fun having you here tonight. It really was. And I hope we have a chance to catch up with you again, you and your sock puppet, Dave.
Wait a minute, Dave, is there some backstory on that one?
No, I don't know. I just kind of made that up. I mean, Dave sounds like a good name for a... Yeah, I mean, well, actually, you see, we got that idea from Grant. I think, didn't Grant have a sock puppet at one time or... Maybe it was Steve Vischer in Australia. I don't know, but we'll have to ask him about that.
Well, anyway, I know you guys have a lot more to talk about on the show. So, again, thanks a lot for inviting me, and I'd be happy to be on any time in the future.
Great. Our pleasure.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australian News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, April 15th, 2013.
Well, g'day, folks, and welcome to the Australia Desk for episode 244. And, of course, that voice you hear at the other end of the line is not Grant McHaren. It's our West Australian correspondent, Ben Jones. How are you, mate?
Yes, it is, and I'm very good, Steve.
Now, you're sitting in for Grant tonight. Grant is unfortunately not well, and for those people who may not be familiar with your work with us here at PCDU, you're our West Australian correspondent. You're based across the other side of the country from me over in Perth.
Yes, I think we can do the comparison to the east coast of United States, where you are, and I would be on the west coast.
Absolutely, and of course, in line with US weather patterns, the weather is always nicer over on the west coast.
It is always nicer on the west coast, except for this week. It's actually raining and drizzling for once.
Ben, we ran you ragged when you came over here for Avalon recently. Have you recovered from that?
I have recovered from my Avalon trip. It was meant to be a holiday, but 18-hour days for 7 or 8 days straight. It certainly was a holiday of love, put it that way.
Yeah, indeed, it was a very busy week. Well, speaking of WA, we thought we might talk about some West Australian news. It's been a pretty quiet news week over here in Australia this week, but there has been a bit of news around about SkyWest Airlines. Now, the WA state airline, I guess, is the way they plug themselves over there. And Ben, I noticed this week an article that's come out in australianaviation.com.au notes that the first Fokker 100 has come out in Virgin colours, and that's interesting. This week, in fact, Virgin made a press release to the Australian Stock Exchange announcing that the acquisition of SkyWest is complete and that, in fact, SkyWest will be removed from the Australian Stock Exchange, and there you go. It's the assimilation is complete. So interesting that Fokker 100s will be progressively painted into the Virgin Australia colour scheme. That'll be something new for plane spotters over there in the west.
It certainly will be. The old SkyWest livery was a white aircraft with a light blue and dark blue trim on it, and obviously the naming of SkyWest. I'm just looking at a picture now of the new Virgin paint scheme, and it looks quite nice. So, yeah, it will be different to see it flying over the top of my house when it goes into Perth Airport.
Now, it's an interesting airline. It's had an interesting history, SkyWest, according to some information we've dragged up online here. They've been around since 1963, and they've been around in various different iterations. I guess most notably, they were at one point in their life part of the Ansett Group. Ansett Airlines, of course, disappeared from here in 2002, and since that time, it's been operated by a Singaporean company. So actually, I didn't know that. Ben, did you know it was operated by a Singapore company? I thought they were actually owned by the WA government.
Yes, I was under the understanding that they were operated by the West Australian government, but it doesn't seem to be. I know the West Australian government has a lot to say about their fare prices and the routes that they fly, but yeah, no, they have been a overseas-based company for a while now.
Now, Western Australia is, of course, the largest state in Australia. It takes up about a third of the continent, in fact. It's a huge state, and SkyWest has access to a lot of areas that I guess many of the other airlines don't, and I guess that would be reflected in its fare structure. Ben, now I know in your business dealings day to day you've had occasion to fly with them. How do they compare price wise and service wise to some of the other airlines?
With SkyWest, they have a monopoly on a lot of the common routes in Western Australia. So we're looking at your short haul 1 hour destinations, and they basically price accordingly. So it's not too uncommon for me to fly for an hour on SkyWest and pay $360 each way, which is a bit steep for an hour in the air, especially when you look at some of the deals at the cut price airlines that you have over East, when you're paying $60 or $80 each way up and down the coast of Australia. I think we get the bad end of the pineapple, unfortunately.
Yeah, in fact, you were talking about a route that you fly occasionally that they have exclusive rights to, which is to the city of Geraldton, which is, as you say, about an hour's flight north. How long would it take you to drive from Perth to Geraldton?
It's about 450 kilometres, so just under 5 hours if you stick to the speed limits.
Okay, so about an hour and a half if Grant was driving.
Yes, maybe an hour and a quarter.
Yeah. We can say all these things about Grant when he's not here. He'll be even more sick when he hears this report.
Yeah. Yes, he'll be sorry that he's got a little case of the man flu.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, they're not a huge airline, SkyWest. They've got a fleet of, let's say, they've got Fokker 50s. They've got eight of those. They've got 11 Fokker 100s, one A320 in the fleet with another one on order. And, of course, they've got the ATR 72s, which they've been operating since they started their alliance with Virgin. They've got 11 of those in the fleet, seven on order, and options for eight more. It'll be interesting to see what happens to their fleet composition as they progress further on into the Virgin group. I wonder if Virgin, obviously operating predominantly Boeing 737s, I guess that wouldn't be really appropriate to the sort of work that they do at SkyWest, but with Virgin moving across to Airbus, maybe that might be something that, you know, we see more of at SkyWest in the future.
Yeah, I think for the short term, in the next year or two or maybe 3 years, they will probably keep with the current fleet. It's what works for the routes, but we don't know what was going to happen in the future. A year ago, when Virgin announced an alliance for frequent flyer points with SkyWest, it gave a bit of an inkling that something was in the wind, and everybody thought it, and basically, yeah, it's happened. Virgin has taken over SkyWest.
Now, Ben, you've also had spent some time in the forces, in the Royal Australian Air Force, so I guess you'd be interested in the movements around the country of the surplus F-111 frames. In fact, the last one to fly, the last one to touch down, and the last one to shut engines down in history here in Australia was aircraft A8-109, and that one's recently been transported after some restoration work, transported by road, I might add, down to the Historic Aircraft Restoration Society up in Wollongong over in New South Wales. Looking at some of the pictures here that the Air Force has supplied and here in some of the magazine articles, boy, they've done some great restoration work on that aircraft. I guess the engines are now inoperable, if they're there at all. But yeah, we know that aircraft has been painted up and it looks, it looks brand new.
It does. It certainly has a nice shiny gleam to them. Now, I was privy to see the F-111s operate when they were still on one of the mainstream aircraft in the RAF, and they certainly didn't look like that example. The colour scheme was the same, but there certainly was no sheen on the paintwork.
Yeah, in fact, they've gone back to the old sort of disruptive pattern camouflage that they had. A lot of the F-111s that were operating, in fact, it may have been all of them, when we saw them at their retirement operations up there a couple of years back, were painted sort of in the grey colour scheme, but this one's been repainted in the more jungle camouflage disruptive pattern. So actually, it looks a lot better in that scheme, I think.
I think it's more reflective of the mid-1980s colour scheme. You would see quite regularly on a lot of the now YouTube videos where the aircraft is doing the 50 feet beat up over the hills. That was the colour scheme of the day. So, yeah, bit of history back in the paint scheme.
Absolutely. Now, the main Air Force base in WA, of course, is RAF-based Pierce. Did the F-111s ever make their way over there very frequently when they were flying?
They would drop in once or twice per year for exercises. But most of the exercises for the F-111s when they were out of Queensland were held in Darwin. So it was very rare to see the F-111s except for air shows at Pierce.
Okay, well, speaking of the Royal Australian Air Force, and, you know, as we're talking about an old, now retired airframe that won't be flying anymore, to a new airframe that still hasn't flown, and, of course, that's the Australian F-35s. A quick article here this week in theaustralian.com.au talks about Australia's first two F-35 Joint Strike Fighter airframes progressing further down the production line. Ben, these aircraft are designated AU-1 and AU-2, and it looks like they're on schedule for delivery next year in the US, and I guess those aircraft we've seen reports we'll be staying there while conversion training commences. So interesting. I don't know what your opinion of the F-35 is. Grant's pretty concerned about it, and there's been a lot of controversy over the years talking about it. I don't know. I guess we're so far down the path with this aircraft now, we sort of really can't pull out of it now, although I notice other nations are doing so. But I'm sure that many of Australia's Air Force pilots, despite all this controversy, would be well looking forward to getting over and flying those aircraft.
Definitely. My involvement in the Air Force might slow down what I can publicly say about the aircraft, but I think another asset coming online would be great for the Royal Australian Air Force. Personally, I don't think the F-35 is the aircraft, but we, as you said before, we're financially committed to the project, and I just hope that we can sort out a lot of the issues as they come to light, and have a nice, decent multi-role aircraft.
We're seeing a lot of the US Defence Force aircraft now coming online. I see that the a couple of British airframes are now flying. So, you know, despite all the controversy, I'm quite looking forward to seeing those aircraft up in the air, not only in Australian markings, but having Australian aircrew flying them.
Yeah, I certainly hope the F-35, the Joint Strike Fighter, does what it's designed to do, and I hope it fills the capability and the role that we need in Australia for the Air Force.
Well, folks, as we wrap this one up, a bit of shameless self-promotion this week. Speaking of military aircraft, we've released another PCDU video this week, and that's covering my ride on the KC-30A, the multi-role tanker transport, five of which are now operating with the Royal Australian Air Force. And, you know, I don't like doing video. I've got a great head for radio, but it was an interesting video to make, and I hope you enjoy watching it. We'll put links to that in the show notes. Ben, thanks for coming and joining us at such short notice. I'm very grateful for the fact that you made it, and I'm very grateful for the fact that you're so far away that the time zones made it work.
Yeah, no, it's been a pleasure to be on the segment finally, Steve.
You know, if Grant keeps being crook like this, we might have to give him the sack and you can fill in for him. You'll have to learn how to speak Kiwi, though.
Oh, I don't know if I can do that.
I don't know that anyone can do that except for actual Kiwis. So before we get into any more trouble, we'll sign off here. Until next week, I'm Steve Vischer.
I'm Ben Jones.
Cheers, folks.
All right, thanks, Steve and Ben. And now here's Peter Johnson across the pond.
Today, I'm joined by my fellow co-host from Extended, Gareth Stringer, editor at Global Aviation Resource. Gareth, welcome to Across the Pond.
Oh, hello, Peter. How are you?
I'm very good. Thanks for joining me on Across the Pond. Obviously, familiar territory for us. But I wanted to have a chat with you about the activity at Global Aviation Resource, because we've seen a massive refresh of what's going on there. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're up to?
Yeah, no, I mean, it was a massive refresh as well, really. We are rapidly approaching our fourth birthday, believe it or not, and the website, which has stood us in very good stead, looked like it was 4 years old. That's what I'm telling everybody. It's incredible how these things happen. So we're sort of, since the turn of this year, been working very hard behind the scenes to build a new website, which really has changed the way that we present our content completely. So quite a big deal for us,
and it really comes across more as a family of aviation and aerospace products now as well.
Yeah, well, I think that that's developed over the 4 years. Obviously, it just started as the website, and then we launched the Hangar.tv, which is a sort of social network for aviation enthusiasts. We have our podcast, obviously, Extended. We've got Get Into Flying and a digital magazine. So it has really grown in the 4 years, and it is a family. That's kind of how we think of it.
Yeah, let's talk about a few of those products there. The Hangar seems to have had a resurgence. I know we talked about it, a year, maybe even longer ago, when you launched it. But it's really popular. You know, there's some aviation photography discussion boards on there and some really good stuff to get involved in.
There is. It's like when anyone asks me about it, I tell them it's like Facebook for aviation enthusiasts, and that's really what it is and how it works. You can blog on there, you can post pictures, you can chat on there live with other people that are logged in. There is a sort of classic forum element, you know, posting questions or talking points or whatever it might be. And I think there's pretty much 1,000 people on there, and it chugs away quite nicely. So So it's working quite well. It's bright and colourful, and that the engine behind that has got some big changes coming. So that again will probably get a refresh in the coming months, I should imagine. So that's quite exciting.
Yeah, and we talked to John on the last episode of Extended about the progress he's made on getting to flying. Let's have a look at some of the other new things that you've got. You've got some great new contributors and some really interesting material.
We've got a big team now. And that's what you need. You know, you need people out there getting content, taking pictures, and not just in the UK. You know, we're not called Global Aviation Resource for nothing. We've always tried to bring content from across the globe. We're always looking for new people to join the team. So we've got a couple of people. I mean, Gordon Jones, who is UK based, has had his own website and is a very, very talented photographer. And we all know Gord quite well, and asked him and said, look, why don't you come and join us? So we're delighted to have him on board. And then we've got people like Christian Brandkamp, who's just joined us. Christian is based in Holland. Is becoming very, very well known for his air-to-air photography, and has had some fantastic trips that he's arranged, you know, with the likes of Spitfires and such like. Very, very talented, and an absolute pleasure to have him on board. And content-wise, you know, it just keeps coming, and as ever, we look to cover every aspect of aviation, so everything from sort of gliding and ballooning right through to sort of the big airline and modern military heavy metal. So that's not going to stop.
And I think the one thing that really grabs me as I sit and flick through the site is there's definitely a step up in quality that's been required, I think, in the past few years. And you guys have got some stunning photography on there. I mean, the Northolt night shoot springs to mind, and some of that, as you say, some of the air-to-air and even some of the ground-to-air photography is world-class.
Well, thank you, first of all. You stand and fall by the quality of your content in this day and age, and I think we're all aware, you know this, and everybody listening will know this, that, you know, people switch on and switch off and move on to other things very quickly these days. So you've got to make an immediate impact to keep people on your site and keep them coming back to your site. And whilst we're very proud of the words we put together and the interviews and such like, there's no question that it's the imagery, I think, which immediately grabs people's attentions. And we are very, very lucky. We've got a fantastic team of photographers. I wouldn't include myself among that. Most of the others are far better than me. But we're very, very lucky to have them. And they'll still be out there taking lovely pictures, and we'll be sharing them with everybody.
Well, I will put a shout out for you. Your shots of the Merlins at Odeon was it Odeon? No, it wasn't.
It was at Benson, and Benson, we can all get lucky.
No, it's a great shot. It's a great shot. But one thing that's also evolved over the past few years is you've had a magazine. I've really enjoyed flicking through it. I was a bit of a latecomer to some of the technology on your laptop, your iPad, your iPhone, in terms of magazines, and was reluctant to let go of my hard copies. But I did with your magazine, really enjoyed it. What's the future for the magazine looking like?
Well, it's definitely got a future. We've been going for 18 months now. It was a new concept. You know, it is a magazine, but it is digital only, so PC, Mac, and your Apple and sort of Android devices. We actually have spent 12 months in partnership with a company called Pocket Mags, and actually selling the magazine as a commercial entity and giving that a go. That actually has come to an end, and whilst I can't say too much more at the moment, people should keep an eye out on the site, because we've got some big new exciting developments coming with the mag. And it's a brilliant format for us. Unlike print, we have no restriction on how many pages, how many pictures, and all those sorts of things. So we can really go to town with the articles and make them really compelling and sort of visually stunning. And that is going to carry on, I'm delighted to say. People are just going to have to wait just a few weeks for it to come back, because we're doing a bit of work behind the scenes.
Right, okay. I've got to say, I think the article that stood out for me was the Mildenhall article, which looked back over the last couple of decades of traffic at Mildenhall. Absolutely fantastic.
We're very lucky in that some of our team, like me, are at the slightly older end of the spectrum. So as well as having guys out there taking lots of pictures now, we've got a fantastic archive to draw upon, going, you know, right back to the sort of, you know, 50s and 60s. And I won't mention the names where they come from, but we have got a couple of guys who've got pretty amazing archives of images. And we're in a lovely situation now where if we need a picture of something, one of our guys has normally got something. That's a nice place to be in.
Well I can definitely ask my colleague Rob Mark to have a look at that. He was based as a air traffic controller at Mildenhall a few years back, so we'll be able to reminisce at that. Gareth, thanks very much for joining us and telling us a little bit about the developments at Global Aviation Resource. Where can we find you online?
Best place to head to is globalaviationresource.com. That's a landing page which can take you to all of the family. And I must just say thank you very much for having me on again. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks for joining us, Gareth.
Thanks, Peter.
This is Peter Johnson reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
Very good. Thanks, Peter and Gareth. Our listener story this episode comes from Andrew Brown. This is a story about his flight in a tiger moth. Now, Andrew sent in an email, and the story is great. We would have loved it if Andrew had made a recording, but he didn't. And the story is so great that what I've done is I've recorded it for him. And so here's my reading of Andrew's story. Andrew Brown, Tiger Moth Flight. Hi, geeks. Last October, I was fortunate enough to have a flight in a tiger moth. You mentioned it on the show and said you thought a report from the flight might be worth having. I flew from Compton Abbas Airfield in Dorset, England. The airfield is a grass strip on top of the Dorset Chalk Downs, a designated area of outstanding natural beauty. I arrived at the airfield about 10 o'clock on a Saturday morning. I mention this because the airfield, being on top of the downs, rose like an island out of the morning mist that cloaked the landscape around. The airfield sits on the western edge of the downs, with the beautiful Blackmoor Vale stretching away below. The church spire of the nearby town of Shaftesbury was pretty much the only other visible feature in the landscape. I met my pilot, a lovely, engaging lady who flies for the airlines and flies tiger moths for fun at the weekends. After the briefings, I was put into a leather flying jacket and helmet and goggles. Authentic look, but actually necessary for the cold and wind blast. The aircraft is a beautiful dark blue and silver. She was built in the 1930s, and unusually, she wasn't called up for military service during the Second World War. She appeared to me to be in absolute mint condition. We were delayed taking off by about 30 minutes. The engine wouldn't start. My family were a bit concerned at this, but it was explained that it's not uncommon for the engine to be a bit reluctant. The airplane had been kept in a temporary hangar overnight, as its normal one is being rebuilt. The temporary hangar is unheated, and the engine was cold and damp. The engine in the Tiger Moth has inverted cylinders, and apparently the oil can collect on the bottom of the cylinders, and the engine doesn't like getting damp. Once the engine starts, it's as good as gold, apparently, never misses a beat. If the engine did fail, though, the Tiger Moth is a good, stable glider and will virtually land itself if you know what you're doing. So I'm told, I'm not a pilot. She eventually started, after much fretting and assistance from a hairdryer to blow warm air on some vital parts. The takeoff was a bit bumpy over the undulating grass, and then we were up. We took in some of the beautiful scenery and flew over my parents' house. We could see the English Channel away to the south. I think we were between 2,000 and 3,000 feet most of the time. There was no noticeable wind, and the airplane felt stable and gave me lots of confidence. I found I needed only a finger and thumb on the control column, with positive pressure required to move it, but with only small movements. I kept her straight and level by lining up part of the windshield frame with the horizon. I had a go at some banks and turns, and the instructor took us through some lazy eights, which were great fun. So much so, in fact, we did some more. My favorite part in these is as the engine is throttled back and the aircraft dives, the wind really whistles through the rigging wires. I then flew us back to almost the threshold of the runway, with the instructor taking over as we approach the steep hillside. This causes a noticeable updraft and a bit of turbulence just before you cross the threshold. The stillness of the air, the mist wreathing the veil below, and the amazing light, coupled with the enthusiasm and friendliness of my instructor, meant this flight was more wonderful than I ever anticipated. I've been very lucky with flying. Pre-2001, I visited the cockpit of a 737 en route to Moscow, and I visited the cockpit of a C-130J en route to Gibraltar. I've flown in military helicopters at below treetop height, being inserted into the tightest landing zones, and had a day being a door gunner on Westland Wessex. I've had a Chinook literally bouncing off my helmet as I was trying to hook up an underslung vehicle, to the extent I had to drop flat and roll off the vehicle. As a civilian flight paramedic, I've landed on missions at iconic tourist sites like the British Museum in the heart of London, all very dramatic and exciting, but not anything near the experience of this Tiger Moth flight. To be at the controls of this wonderful living example of aviation heritage in such picturesque surroundings, in such beautiful weather, was just humbling and inspiring. I don't have the kind of money right now, but my ambition for the future is to get my micro pilot's license, because it's relatively cheap and is hands-on, seat-of-the-pants flying, and then upgrade by stages to flying Tiger Moths. Thanks again for a great show and all the hard work you guys put into it. All the best, Andrew Brown. All right, very good. Andrew, thank you so much for sending that in. What a great experience. Again, we're encouraging listeners to send us your story, preferably recorded. Get out your smartphone or your laptop or whatever's got the recording capability and create a little 2-3 minute, 4 minute recording and tell us about the first flight you can remember. Tell us about that person or that event that sparked your interest in aviation when you were young. Anything like that. Send those to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com and we'll look to play it on the show. So again, thanks to Andrew, and we'll have another one next week.
Hi guys, Steve Tupper from the Airspeed Podcast and the president of the Rob Mark Fan Club. You're listening to the Airplane Geeks.
Moving on to listener mail. First one comes from actually Trucker Pete. This is just a brief voicemail. Rob, I don't know if you've heard this, but I think you'll like it. We talked a couple of episodes ago about the number of aviation organization leaders that are have left or moved on or will be, and the number of openings that are there. Of course, we have the AOPA. An opening coming up. So here's Trucker Pete.
Hello, geeks. This is Trucker Pete, first time, long time. I've been an AOPA member for a number of years. I'm an aircraft owner and pilot. And there's an individual who I would like to support for the new president of AOPA. Hopefully you can sway some of your listeners to support this individual. It's been a long time proponent of aviation, and I feel would represent the AOPA very well. Aunt Benet for president.
Well, I think I could get behind that. What do you think, Rob?
I think we should spring that on her and see what she says.
Yeah, I think that'd be great. So thanks to Trucker Pete for sending that in. Very much appreciated. We also heard from our pal Stephen Tornbloom. Here's Stephen.
Hey guys, it's Stephen out in California. Just listening to episode 143, I believe it is, with Igor Sikorsky. Just wanted to make one quick comment to Rob, who said that Vancouver is the coolest float plane base in the world. I personally have not been up there, but I have been to Lake Hood in Anchorage, Alaska. And let me tell you, you think Vancouver is cool? You need to go to Lake Hood in about July or early August. That place is buzzing. I believe that is actually the world's largest or most active seaplane base in the world, especially during the summertime. That place will have your head spinning. So Anyway, that's it. Keep up the good work, and back to the podcast.
Yeah, that sounds like a cool idea.
Yeah.
I like that. Steven works for Anaconda Airlines, actually. we won't mention, but that Anaconda doesn't go to Alaska, so we need to work on that. But I think that'd be really neat. Have you been up to Alaska, Jeff?
I've been there a few times in my Air Force days when I was flying the C-141. Beautiful place.
Oh, yeah. You know, I looked up Lake Hood Seaplane Base on Wikipedia, and it says it is the world's busiest seaplane base. Of course, we know Wikipedia is always correct, but they mention that they handle an average of 190 flights a day, which is that's pretty impressive. That's pretty impressive. So, Jeff, have you ever been on a float plane? Have you ever flown a?
You know, I haven't. I haven't. I want to. You know, that's for many pilots. That's like, you know, you got to have that that rating, you know, to be complete. But no, I have never flown on or in a float plane.
Yeah, that it just seems like this, such an exciting thing to do.
Absolutely. You know, I'd really love to fly in one of those old flying boats. You know, like the clippers and that kind of thing. I grew up in Southern California, and we'd head over to Avalon Bay, Catalina. And I remember as a kid, going over there and seeing I forgot what the name of the company was, but it was a Catalina Air or something like that. They flew a few of those amphibious float or flying boats, and it was so cool to watch them come in and land in the harbor and taxi up. Really cool.
Well, what was that model that Igor was saying that he takes people for rides in when he was on last week, Max?
You mean his?
Didn't Igor Skorsky? Yeah, he mentioned a flying boat of some kind of his dad's or his grandfather's, I guess, or something.
No, he was talking about his plane.
Oh, I see. I thought he meant that he had a flying boat or something small at the camp. Ah, okay. Never mind. You can just take this part out.
All right.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on.
Next comes from Patrick. He noted that in Peter's Across the Pond segment, I think this was in episode 242, when Peter was talking about NASA and space, and he mentioned that there were at least a billion planets in our solar system. And, of course, Peter meant to say a billion planets in our galaxy. So Patrick was very sharp and caught that. But Patrick went on, and I think this is very cool. I like this a lot. Patrick says that he wanted to thank us for recently mentioning the Women of Aviation Worldwide program. He says, and my small part in it. As a follow-up, I'll say that while I've not made any progress with the Girl Scouts, recent media coverage of my efforts have afforded me a number of chances to introduce girls and women to flying. He says, special mention goes to a flight I made this past Saturday with 8-year-old Cadence and her father. She sat right up front and did much of the flying. He says, really, she did. Light chop didn't bother her. She loved doing the roller coaster and even helped with the landing flare. He said, but something happened right at the end that made the flight even more special. As we pulled off the active, I keyed the mic on the CTAF. What's a CTAF?
Common traffic advisory frequency.
Okay.
So that's the frequency they use when the tower's shut.
So you call it CTAF?
Yeah, pretty much.
Pretty much? Okay, so see, we can all learn something on this show. I keyed the mic on the CTAF and told everyone in the area that my 8-year-old passenger had just made her first flight in an airplane and had even helped with the landing. That was followed by congratulatory remarks from other aircraft in the area. You should have seen the huge smile on Cadence's face when she heard all the kudos. He said it was priceless. So that's what a great story. That's fantastic. We're always interested in, of course, of introducing new people, new youngsters to aviation because, well, they might grow up someday, be just like Rob or Jeff.
I mean, how could you get any better than that? Yeah, I like this show more and more, Max.
Okay.
Keep stroking our backs.
All right, very good. Interesting letter from Tracy. Actually, interesting email from Tracy. He talked about the episode with Jack Pelton, in some discussion about the A320, the one that descended into the trees. A reader sent in some information that seemed hard to believe. I just remember parts of the discussion. I think this was about the fuses, wasn't it, Rob, where single fuse maybe could control several different systems?
Yeah, and Jeff, to bring you up to speed on that, somebody, I forgot exactly how the discussion came up, but we were talking about the cockpit, and somebody said, well, some of the Airbuses have a breaker with more than one use, and I had just never heard of anything like that before. I mean, because to me that seemed like it would completely defeat the purpose of a breaker being tied to a particular system, because you would never know how to isolate it. But they were insistent, and I think that's what this is following up on, although honestly I'm still not quite sure that I understand all this.
Well, Tracy adds some information from the A320 operating manual. He said that's the of the airline that he used to work for, that describes the engine idle system. It says that you'll see that in order to force the engines into the lower idle mode, one would have to either disable the sensors for wing slat position or the on-the-ground sensor. When these slats are extended in flight, the computers assume you're in an approach mode and bump up the idle speed to enable a quicker spool up to go around power. So disabling the slat position sensor would prevent the higher idle restriction associated with approaches. He says the other option to obtain ground idle is to try and trick the computers into believing the airplane is on the ground. That system receives inputs from things like strut extension and radar altitude, and sends inputs to things like the landing gear handle and the pressurization system. He says, I'm not sure how you would trick the plane into thinking it was on the ground. I can remember another plane that could be tricked into thinking it was in the air, but not the reverse, by disabling the on-the-ground sensors.
I had a co-pilot once that tricked me into thinking he could fly. Then one day I found out he was not very good. Okay. I guess that's another story. Anyways, his name was Dave. Dave the sock puppet.
Okay. It had nothing to do with the circuit breaker either, did it?
No.
Nothing. Nothing at all. But the operating manual is kind of interesting. He talks about how there's idle control. That's where the FADEC has three idle modes: modulated idle, reverse idle, and approach idle. It says modulated idle, or sometimes called ground idle, is selected when the aircraft's on the ground, provided that reverse thrust is not selected. And while airborne, with the slats retracted, says idle RPM depends on bleed system demand, which makes sense, oil temperature, and Mach number. And then reverse idle is selected when the thrust reversers are in the rev idle position, and it's slightly higher than the modulated idle. And then there's approach idle. And that's designed to allow the engines to accelerate rapidly from idle to toga thrust. Toga, T-O-G-A, something to go around. Take off, go around thrust. It's a good thing I have all these pilots around here. And is automatically selected whenever the slats are extended.
So it doesn't mention anything about couch potato idle? Or
no.
I guess maybe that was another show. Okay.
Yeah.
Jeff, you sure you don't want to go? I mean, it's going to get worse. It really is.
Gosh, I feel like I should have left earlier.
Yeah. All right. You'll be sorry. Wait.
I'm just kidding.
Next, let's go to Chris. This is Chris in Tokyo. He's writing again. He said he wanted to share some thoughts about Skytrax. That's a commercial aviation ranking service. Now, this is kind of interesting comment. Skytrax, it's a comprehensive, he says, UK-based research group. And the website states that it works with airlines, but it's more well-known for its annual airline and airport rankings and awards. And also in Skytrax, there's a section, travelers, you can write in comments and relate experiences for most of these carriers. But Chris is kind of questioning the sort of the value of Skytrax, or you know, how accurate it might be. If you haven't seen Skytrax, you can find that at it's at www.airlinequality.com. That'll take you to Skytrax. But I mean, there are a number of different services or places you can go to see airline rankings or ratings by either experts or by passengers. I don't know. Jeff, maybe you've got some thoughts on sort of the value. I always see these things as, you know, people who have complaints are more likely to contribute to this, whereas people who are, you know, had a fine experience are less likely to go off and type into some website that they had a fine experience. What do you, any observations on that?
Yeah, I think that's true with just about any industry. You know, you're not going to, if you're going to receive good service or, you know, satisfactory service, you're not going to go out of your way to make sure somebody knows about it. And you're right. I think that the people that have bad experiences are the ones that are going to be or take the time to go to a site like Skytrax and rank an airline or a company. I think that it doesn't really matter, even if it's the, what, Singapore Airlines, you know, the best airline, always, you know, top-ranked airline. Mm. There are probably people out there that have bad experiences with them. And, you know, it's I know that some airlines have more than their fair share of providing bad service, and they probably deserve the lower rankings. But I get people all the time telling me, oh, you fly for Acme. Well, let me tell you about the flight that I had, blah, blah, blah. And I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, you know, I don't have anything to do with that. You know, I wasn't the captain on that flight. I had no control over that, but I still have to sit there and smile and listen. And you know, it's like somebody coming, like going up to my neighbor who happened to work for IBM and then just start, you know, laying into him about, you know, what a piece yeah. of, you know, what the IBM computer is. I mean, the guy didn't have anything to do with that. So I don't know. That's human nature, I think.
Yeah. In all of these things, I tend to take the most glowing reviews and the most damning reviews and just ignore them. You know, throw out the best, throw out the worst, because, you know, the best probably works for the company. The worst probably is some, you know, idiot that didn't know what he was doing in the first place. I probably shouldn't say that, but you know what I mean. I just throw out the extremes and then go for the stuff in the middle. And I find that usually gives me the best indication of what it's really like. But
or better yet, just ask me my opinion about it.
Yeah. AirlinePilotGuy.com.
There you go. .com.
Captain Jeff.
Well, and you know, everybody, I don't think there's an airline, as Jeff said, I don't think there's an airline in the world. I don't think there's a corporate flight in the world that doesn't screw up sometimes. Stuff happens. It just does. But it's how the company or the company's representatives react to that situation that is what people remember. And, you know, I mean, you can be stuck on the ramp on you know, for 2 hours on X, you know, on Acme airplane or on Anacondas or whatever, and they may treat people very, very differently. And each will, you know, certainly be the recipient of whatever that group of people were treated to. And, you know, you catch somebody on a bad day in the cabin, you know, maybe they're fatigued. Maybe it's the last day of a 4-day trip and they want to go home and they get stuck and they're cranky and they just got a cell phone message from their kids before they left. And anybody can have that. But again, what does the company do when you call them and say, wow, I had a really miserable experience? Do they say, oh, sorry, it's been nice chatting with you, though? I mean, or do they? And I'm not necessarily saying give somebody something. I really do believe that a lot of times people just want to. They just want to talk to somebody they think is actually listening to
them.
And that makes such a difference. And that's where some of our carriers don't do such a great job. And I can think of one. Let's see, if we've got Acme and we've got Anaconda, what's another good one that we could call United? I mean, an airline that's based in the town I'm at that shall go nameless. They used to call it Untied.
Untied, ago, yeah,
but
sure.
That's another story. Okay. Yeah,
I think there's a website about that. All right, next up, we heard from Ron again. Now, you two guys are going to have to explain this question to me, let alone the answer, because I don't understand what he's talking about, but you will. Ron writes, just wondering if anyone knows how many airliners may have ADS-B out. He says, this relates to getting ADS-B traffic on the many portable devices, but without an out, there is no wake-up signal to ground-based transmitter to send the data. Okay. Who can decipher that for me and the rest of the listeners who don't know what he's talking about?
I think most airliners, the ADS-B is in. So I don't know about the ones that have them out.
Well, you know, I was trying to think about this one myself, and I believe that while they don't all have it, it's getting to be more prevalent on the international airplanes, because in order to use the organized track system across the North Atlantic, I believe two out of the daily six tracks were kind of a set of superhighways, essentially parallel to each other across the Atlantic. And in order to use two of them at certain primo altitudes, they're requiring airplanes to start coming fully equipped with ADS-B, which is in and out by pretty. In fact, I think we just passed the deadline for that. So, but that again doesn't mean that all the airplanes in the U.S. Are ADS-B out. But that's an interesting question to research. We'll have to look into that.
And I'd like to apologize because I tried to make a joke, but I think you guys thought I was serious.
Oh, I did. I didn't know what you were
saying. I'm sorry. Oh,
I'd like to apologize to Max and to Rob and to Ron, who sent in the question. But
sometimes I get too dopey.
I think that your answer was good. I think that more and more of the more modern airplanes are coming equipped with ADS-B out. And I do know that the upgrade to the Mad Dog that I fly at Acme is going to have GPS and ADS-B and traffic information, TI, I think they call it, all this kind of new fancy stuff for the next-gen system. So
you also fly for Mad Dog Airlines?
Yes, Mad Dog Airlines, yes.
Yeah, yeah, I think I've heard of them. Okay. So, Ron, I hope that answered your question, dude. Ron's a new CFI, so you know, he wants to know everything.
We'll make this one the last listener email. This is from Andrew. He said, I saw the story on the Sky News iPhone app, wondered if we'd seen it. This is about the turbulence. There's some indications that global warming is creating more turbulence and that over the ocean, I guess, and that means that less pleasant flights for flyers, and might even mean the need to fly different routes that are longer in order to avoid this turbulence, and therefore that means more oil, more fuel consumed. It's kind of sort of a cascading situation that is not very green, to say the least. Jeff, do you fly? How much do you alter your flight plan based on the turbulence that you expect to encounter? Is there a lot of that, really?
Yeah, it depends on the severity of the turbulence. If it's greater than moderate, the dispatchers, the professional dispatchers, will look at alternative either routes or altitudes or both to avoid those areas if they know about it beforehand. And so it happens quite a bit, actually. But I think what's going to happen here, using my crystal ball, I think I read one of these articles regarding the I think somebody else asked that question on my show that I haven't answered yet. So this is good practice. they said that one of these articles said that it's going to kind of peak in based on their models. Of course, you know, this is weather and you know how all that goes in the year 2050. So number one, I'll probably be long dead. Number two, but that has no bearing on my answer here. I think that they'll continue to fly these tracks. They'll just make sure that everybody is seated for the entire flight with their seatbelts fastened. And they'll use those new seats. I don't know if you saw those seats where they had built-in toilets into the seat. And so you won't have any reason to get up. So you'll be.
Is this another joke?
Yes.
I think Dave the sock puppet is starting to get to Jeff here. I think we've created a monster. But Jeff, if it really gets bad, just tell him it wasn't your fault. We did something to you on the Airplane Geeks and we sent you weird radio waves. And that's why you're like that.
Yes, well,
Andy, everybody believe that.
Yeah, again, Andy, I apologize to the listener that sent in the feedback. I'm sorry. I think that it is definitely probably or possibly going to happen, and I agree that the routings will have to be changed to avoid the nasty stuff because it's just dangerous, and it's going to kind of result in longer flights and more fuel burned and more CO2 emissions and all that kind of bad stuff.
Well, Andy sent a number of kind of interesting links, and we'll put them all in the show notes. If you're interested in climate change and some of the effects of that, these are some interesting articles. So look for those in the show notes. All right, I think that'll do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Thank goodness.
I know.
I mean, bye, Dave.
Are you getting tired, Rob?
Well, no, I'm not. But Dave, the sock puppet, is yawning.
Oh, man.
I think Rob's getting tired of me, so.
So, Jeff, tell our listeners once again where they can find you and your podcast online.
Well, I'll be playing at the Airline Pilot Guy Lounge all week. So come and see me there. Airline Pilot Guy, all one word, .com. And you can find me on iTunes where your aviation podcasts are found.
All right. Very good. We'd like to thank our contributors, as always. This time, Steve Vischer and Ben for the Australia Desk. Also, Peter Johnson with Gareth this time on Across the Pond. And so let's tell folks where they can find us online, Rob. We'll start with you because David's not here, so we can't start with David.
Oh, no, you don't mean David the sock puppet, right?
No, our David.
You know, maybe we should tell David he's been replaced by a sock puppet because he's missed a number of days this year, and that if he doesn't improve upon his attendance, we're going to replace him with David the sock puppet. We'll save that for another time. People can find me at jetwine.com, at jetwine on Twitter, at jetwine on Facebook, what else? I don't know. Other places around Facebook. I don't know. Put my name in. See what comes up. Tell me what you find. I mean,
something will.
If it's really odd on second thought, you know, just kind of skip those.
And I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Google Plus and Twitter. Just look for Max Flight. You can find show notes at airplanegeeks.com. This is episode 244. You'll find links there to all the sites we mentioned on the podcast. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Google Plus. Just look for Airplane Geeks. And we're also on Stitcher.com, where you can stream us right to your mobile phone. If you want to send us email, the address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And, of course, we have a listener line where you can leave us an audio message. Our favorite candidate for the new AOPA position is Benet. Here she is.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.
Now, you know how Grant starts his off by doing the Dateline?
Yep.
So you'll have to do that this week.
Okay.
So just say Dateline, April 15th, 2013, or 2013, your choice.
Do I have to do it in a Kiwi accent?
That's your choice. Jeez, I didn't know you got access to those carriers. You know, are you offering any jobs, mate? Maybe I could put in a job application and come over there and work with you.
That sounds good, Steve. Send me your resume.
I hope you pay a little more than we pay you here at Playing Crazy Down Under, mate.
Oh, I could probably slip you an extra $10 a week.
Yeah. So I'd be paid $10 a week.
Yes. I've got a reminder to talk to you about that about too.
So, well, wait a minute. If we play this part at the start and then they hear Dave. Dave and his sock puppet, Jeff. No, I...
Wait a minute. Jeff
at the end, won't they say, what? He came back.
Yeah, you could say, well, we just couldn't get rid of the guy.
Well, actually, Jeff left, but Dave is here.
Here's
Dave.
Hi.
Yeah, see, you realize we're going to have started something, and then one of these days you're going to do it and say, you know, it wasn't really my idea, but it's actually kind of cool, and Dave and I now have quite a chat about the industry, and
I'm going to be touring around the nation.
I am, with my act. Yeah.
All right. Hey, let's do some listener mail.
Okay.
Oh, that's well.
I just saw some crazy story about what was it? I can't remember what it was about. Some guy that worked with somebody, and he made a joke about his partner in a sock puppet, and everybody, of course, thought he was making this up. I forgot what he did for a living. It was something very odd. And they said, oh, no, no, he really does have a sock puppet that he brings with him all the time. And I thought, okay, I wouldn't be working with somebody that came to work with a sock puppet, but that's just me.
Well, and perhaps this will be the last thing that I say to you guys, but there was a captain at my airline years ago who purportedly actually did have a sock puppet. And so when he would criticize or give some constructive criticism to the other crew members, he would pull out his sock and bring out his little sock puppet. And the sock puppet would talk to the person and suggest different ways of doing things. And the story goes, I don't know if I have all the details, but it was a former Marine first officer who basically had enough of that, and he basically grabbed the sock puppet, I forgot what the name of it was, and basically strangled it and threatened that sock puppet that if he didn't shut up, that he was going to find a dark place with the owner's anatomy. So basically the captain never pulled out the sock puppet again. So the story goes.
Oh, my gosh.
Some people have no sense of humor.
I know. What's up with that?
I don't know. They're not on this show. That's.
Do we have to start the whole thing over again? Was it that bad?